Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit the webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, about news, about current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on contracts. Where is it in the law? You know, the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of my two-week basic courtroom strategy and procedure school, and this school includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the scene of the crime, at the arrest, or when you're served with a summons, citation, or a complaint. And rule number one is don't say anything, keep your mouth shut, and shut up. Now, if you can learn rule one, you can learn, or you can win about 90% of your legal cases, and that's because all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. Now, government's fully capable of making their own case without any help from you whatsoever, so don't give your prosecution the victory. At least make the government work for it. Now, listen to what the courts have to say about keeping quiet in the face of police interrogation, and indeed, in some cases, police intimidation. First judge said, who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights? He said that in U.S. versus Dickerson. The second judge put it this way. He said, you can and must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment. He said that in Belknap versus United States. The third judge put it this way. He said, the constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent as well as the innocent and farsighted. And he said that in Marchetti versus United States. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, just call the law school at 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for the free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining. It's educational. It's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedures available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, just go to the website, georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email. Send an email request for that free general law CD package. Do it right now before you forget. georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we finished on adhesion contracts. We're answering the question of a listener named Raymond. Raymond wrote a letter and he said, where is it explicitly stated or recorded in any case, law, record, statute, or code that it is a fact that my driver's license, voting registration, or social security number is in fact a contract? So I started off and I said there are several sources of information, and we've been covering these various and sundry sources of information. I'm going to turn now to a case called Diefendorf versus Galay. It's an income tax case, comes from Idaho. Decided back in 1932, Diefendorf versus Galay is cited at 51 Idaho 619. So if you want to look it up, it's 51 Idaho 619, 1932, and on page 633, listen to this statement by the Supreme Court of Idaho. They said, quote, income is necessarily the product of the joint efforts of the state and the recipient of the income. The state furnishing the protection necessary to enable the recipient to produce, receive, and enjoy it. And a tax thereon in the last analysis is simply a portion cut from the income and appropriated by the state as its share thereof. It's a protection racket. That's number one. But it's a contract, it's an agreement, it's a partnership. And a partnership is a contractual arrangement. Remember, a contract is an agreement. It's something that we agree to for the betterment or the enrichment of each or both of us, each one of us. Could be three people in a contract, could be 50 people in a contract, could be 5,000 people. It can be an adhesion contract, it can be a meeting of the minds. There are various types of contracts, and some of these contracts that you enter into, they don't appear to be contracts, but they are. And a contract, remember, has four elements. It's an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration. Four elements to a contract. So anytime you see an offer which has with it an acceptance, because if you have an offer and no acceptance, you can't have a contract. You don't have an agreement. If you have an agreement that has an offer with an acceptance, but you don't have a time limit, time frame, or you don't have consideration, you don't have a contract. There has to be consideration. There has to be a time element. If you have consideration with an offer and agreement, no time element, you don't have a contract. So a judge is sitting here looking for an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration that establishes a contract. Now, what's the highest and best evidence of the contract? Well, typically it's the written document. So here's what happens. In cases where Congress or the legislature does not have constitutional authority to enact a law, as they did in Social Security. So there's nothing in the Constitution that gives Congress the power to put together a social welfare scheme like Social Security. So they can go ahead and do it, and you can voluntarily join the program. And the Supreme Court has ruled that it's constitutional. Of course it's constitutional. There's no problem with that. And it's because it's voluntary. You join it. And it's contractual. Why is it contractual? Well, because Social Security makes an offer. Would you like to join Social Security? In fact, they actually make it a little bit more than an offer. They go far enough. They impose the act as a tax on corporations. And they said, you can't work for General Motors unless you've got a Social Security number. Naturally, you want to work for General Motors or Yellow Freight Lines, and so you go down and get a Social Security number, but you do it voluntarily. Nobody's put a gun to your head and forced you to do anything. There's something that you want, and in order for you to get it, you have to sign this contract, this agreement. And you agree to give 16.1% of your income to Social Security for the benefits that they're going to give you at the end of the program. They spell out the terms and conditions of the agreement. It's called law, but just because it's a law doesn't mean it's not a contract. In fact, if you and I sit down at my desk and we hammer out an agreement, we've got a law that I can sue on. I can take you to court and make you specifically perform or pay a penalty for the breach of that contract, that agreement. Isn't that just special? So contracts are enforced, and they can be civil or criminal. You can agree to go to jail. The state says, do you agree that when you get this license, if you break the terms and conditions of the contract, that we can put you in jail? And you say, well, yeah, I'll agree to that. So you're speeding down the highway, driving without a license, or you're drunk driving, and they take in, and if they can prove that you were drunk driving, they can put you in jail. So don't think that a law isn't a part and parcel of the contract. It's the penal clause to the contract. Now, contracts have to have penal clauses. Otherwise, what you have here is a suggestion rather than a contract. But as a definition of a contract, you don't have to have a penal clause. The penal clause can be applied by the state at some later date. Let's look at this again. Diefendorf versus Goulet. Income is necessarily the product of the joint efforts of the state and the recipient of the income. So there's two parties to this agreement. The state furnishes the protection necessary to enable you, the recipient, to produce, receive, and enjoy income. So the state gives you a valuable consideration. And then you have to pay the tax, which is the consideration on your part. In the last analysis, this tax is simply a portion cut from the income and appropriated by the state as its share of this joint venture, joint effort, this contract, this agreement. That's what income tax is. Income is voluntary because you don't have to join the income tax system. You did because you wanted to participate in commerce, but nobody forced you to. You might have joined because you didn't know any better, but then that doesn't change anything. It's like joining the army and you didn't know what the ramifications were. Now, last time I mentioned to you Hale versus Hinkle. Hale versus Hinkle, cited at 201 U.S. 43, decided back in 1905. Notice here that there are certain rights that individuals have. An individual may stand upon his constitutional rights, and I'm on page 75 here. This is Hale versus Hinkle, 201 U.S. 43, on page 75. The individual may stand upon his constitutional rights as a citizen. The individual is entitled to carry on his private business in his own way. The individual's power to contract is unlimited. The individual owes no duty to the state or to his neighbors to divulge his business or to open his doors to an investigation so far as it may tend to criminate him. The individual owes no such duty to the state since he receives nothing therefrom beyond the protection of his life and property. The individual's rights are such as existed by the law of the land. That's the common law, long antecedent to the organization of the state, and can only be taken from him by due process of law and in accordance with the Constitution. And among his rights are a refusal to incriminate himself and the immunity of himself and his property from arrest or seizure except under a warrant of the law. He owes nothing to the public so long as he does not trespass upon the public's rights. Now, here's a guy that's got rights. Rights are independent from contract, although they're established by contract. Now, a corporation, on the other hand, is a contractual organization. Listen to this. On the other hand, the corporation is a creature of the state, and it's presumed to be incorporated for the benefit of the public, and it receives certain special privileges and franchises and holds them subject to the laws of the state and the limitations of its charter. The charter is the contract. The charter. We call it a charter. We call it a contract. It's an offer by the state. It's an acceptance by the group of individuals that want to establish this corporation, the limited liability entity. And the state taxes it, and that's their share of this joint venture. And there's a time limit. And the time limit is until such and such a date. You have to renew it every year, typically. I remember I had to pay a corporate tax on the Atlantis Manufacturing Company every year. Not only did I pay a tax every year, I had to renew the charter every year and pay a fee. So a corporation is a contract. It's a contractual arrangement, an agreement that you make with the state, which, by the way, violates the first commandment that says you shall have no other gods, you shall have no other sovereigns before me. All right, so that takes care of Hale versus Hinkle. Now, remember, commerce comes into play here, and commerce is predicated upon contract. Listen to this. A federal appeals court Thursday overturned a Mesa, Arizona man's federal conviction of possessing 5 machine guns. A 3-judge panel of the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals of San Francisco reversed the conviction, ruling that the congressional ban does not apply to homemade machine guns and their parts because they were never in the stream of commerce. So when you join commerce under the Commerce Clause, that's a contract. And you have to do that yourself. You have to get up in the morning and go down and sign up for welfare. You got to get up and go down and get a corporate charter. You have to go down and sign up for a driver's license, birth registration, marriage license, business license. You've got to go join commerce to get involved in this. Otherwise, you've got constitutional rights that protect you. This guy's name was Robert Stewart. He was sentenced to 5 years imprisonment for being a felon in possession of firearms and of possessing illegal machine guns last year. The court ruled that there was neither a transfer nor a sale of the weapons or their parts, so Congress did not have the power under the Commerce Clause to regulate homemade guns crafted from scratch. There was no contract in force there. No contract. So when government is prosecuting you, you're being prosecuted for breach of contract. When you're charged with tax evasion, breach of contract. When you're charged with divorce by your wife, breach of contract. When you got welfare lady coming out there and she says, hey, you don't have your kids in public school, breach of contract. You violated the terms and conditions, and the statutes of your state are the contract terms. The legislature, your guardian, is making written demands upon you in the form of contract terms. Buckle your seatbelt, drive 55. Now, remember I mentioned to you that Larry Beecraft said that Social Security wasn't a contract. And I think that his argument against Social Security being a contract is incorrect. And I say it's incorrect because if a contract is an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration, Social Security, then, of and by itself, by its very nature, is a contract because it's voluntary. If it was mandatory, like thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, then you don't have to have a contract. That's enforced upon all of us, whether we like it or not. Now, in the final analysis, it's a contract because the Ten Commandments are a voluntary system or code of law that was agreed to by your great-great-great-granddaddy 84 generations ago, which inures to the heirs and assigns forever. It inures to the heirs and assigns forever. So if you're one of those descendants, the story goes like this. Out of Mount Sinai, God made a deal. He got up on the mountain. He said, if you'll do this, this, that, and another thing, I'll give you these 33 articulable benefits. It's a quid pro quo agreement. And the people said, all that the Eternal has said, we will do and be obedient. But the contract was made between two unequals. You see, God has eternal life and the people do not. So after the property was transferred from God to the people for the specific performance under the terms and conditions of the old covenant, the old contract, that's what a covenant is, the old covenant. Your great-great-great-great-granddaddy died, and a legal question devolved, who gets the toys after great-granddad died? Does it go back to God? Well, no, it couldn't go back to God, because if God could take it, well, then it was his property all along, and you couldn't transfer property from God to man, because man doesn't have eternal life and can't receive it. And so God told Adam and Eve, he said, now listen, I'm going to give you all the gold and silver and brass and iron in the hills. The only thing I'm going to withhold from you people is the land. You'll see that in Leviticus 25:23. He says, the land is mine, the land shall not be sold forever. So the only species of property on planet Earth that we cannot own is land. But we can own gold and silver and brass and children and wives and cattle and dogs and cats and all kinds of chattels and lumber mills and, you know, stocks and bonds. We can own all that kind of stuff. Chattels you can own, land you can't. So, as a result of that, we needed to have an inheritance law, and indeed we got one. It's in Deuteronomy 22, I believe, or something like that. 22, maybe it's 25. And it talks about the firstborn son receiving a double portion. And the book of Proverbs says that a righteous man leaves an inheritance for his children's children. And when the birthright, the inheritance, was passed on to Joseph from his father, Jacob, he passed it directly on to the descendants of Joseph, which were Ephraim and Manasseh. Gave them the birthright. Judah got the scepter, Ephraim and Manasseh got the birthright, Reuben got the shaft. That's another story for another day. So you have to have an inheritance law. An inheritance law is the methodology whereby we move the chattel property from generation to generation. Of course, the state comes in here and they want to take a portion of it. And so the third plank to the Communist Manifesto, or the fourth plank, one or the other, I forgot now which, third or fourth plank, I guess I could look it up for you here. I've got the book right in front of me. Let me flip over here to Chapter 1, Communist Manifesto. We Americans are communists. We've been practicing communism for so long, we thought we invented it. Fourth plank. No, third plank. Calls for the abolition of all right of inheritance. And so in its place, we now have inheritance tax laws implemented by the marriage license. Under the inheritance law, if a man has two wives, one beloved, and the other hated, and they have borne him children, both the beloved and the hated, and if the firstborn son be hers that was hated, then it shall be, when he makes his sons to inherit that which he has, that he may not make the son of the beloved firstborn before the son of the hated, which is indeed the firstborn. But he shall acknowledge the son of the hated for the firstborn by giving him a double portion of all that he has. For he is the beginning of his strength, the right of the firstborn is his. That's in Deuteronomy 21:15-17. So this abolition of all right of inheritance then is the communist philosophy. Inheritance tax is communist. That's not Anglo-Saxon common law. Of course, we Anglo-Saxons despise our common law and our heritage anyway, and we despise God, and we despise the Ten Commandments, and we've thrown them out of the public schools and our public institutions, so it shouldn't be surprising to anybody. I'm just making the report. And of course, when we do that, there are legal consequences that come from it. You know, there's no such thing as an action without an equal opposite reaction. You got actions, and you got consequences. So you have choices to make, and you make those choices, and of course, you get results that come from it. Well, let's go over here to Larry B. Craft, and here's his article. Larry B. Craft's article on Social Security is not a contract. Article 1, Section 9, Clause 7 of the U.S. Constitution provides as follows. No money shall be drawn from the Treasury but in consequence of appropriations made by law. Now, while the constitutional provision does not of itself place a maximum ceiling upon the amount of debt which can be created by Congress, it does hold that appropriating legislation is required in order to incur debts. This is aptly demonstrated by the federal cases which have construed this part of the Constitution, such as Cummings versus Hardy, cited at 102 Fed 2nd, 622, D.C. Circuit, 1939, Maryland Casualty Company versus United States, 155 Fed 2nd, 823, 4th Circuit, 1946, where it was held that officers of the United States lacked all power to pay any claim against the United States in the absence of an appropriation from Congress to pay such claim. This principle was more fully explained in Hughes Aircraft Company versus United States, 534 Fed 2nd, 889, on page 906, Supreme Court, 1976, where the court declared, quote, the second principle is that before any expenditure of public funds can be made, there must be an act of Congress appropriating the funds and defining the purpose for such appropriation. Thus, no officer of the federal government is authorized to pay a debt due from the United States, whether or not reduced to a judgment, unless an appropriation has been made for that purpose. You can also see this in Reeside versus Walker, 52 U.S., 11 Howard, 272, decided in 1850. The Cincinnati Soap Company versus United States, 301 U.S., 308. And the Office of Personnel Management versus Richmond, cited at 110 Supreme Court, 2465, 1990. And you'll find the citation at 20 on page 2471. And in the National Association of Regional Councils versus Costell, 564 Fed 2nd, 583, on page 586, District of Columbia Circuit, 1977. The court elucidated this principle by stating, quote, government agencies may only enter into obligations to pay money if they have been granted such authority by Congress. Amounts so authorized by Congress are termed collectively budget authority and can be subdivided into three conceptually distinct categories, appropriations, contract authority, and borrowing authority. Appropriations permit an agency to incur obligations and to make payments on obligations. Contract authority is legislative authorization for an agency to create obligations in advance of an appropriation, and it requires a subsequent appropriation or some other source of funds before the obligation incurred may actually be liquidated by the outlay of monies. Borrowing authority permits an agency to spend debt receipts. Thus, it is quite apparent that in order for the federal government to incur debt, it must adopt legislation authorizing a specific amount of federal obligations to be incurred. It is easy to demonstrate the operation of this provision of the Constitution and its application to government contracts. Suppose the feds desired to build a new courthouse at a cost of $200 million. An agency in charge of such a project could theoretically contract with a construction company to build the structure. However, until Congress actually appropriates money to pay for construction, there's no contract. And even if the contractor, in this example, incurred lots of costs preparing to build this courthouse, which ultimately does not get built because of a lack of funds, he has no claim against the government for breach of contract. And the same principle applies to every other government contractor, whether aerospace, military, etc. Government contracts are unique and different from private sector contracts due to this contractual limitation upon the power to contract. Is Social Security a contract? A private insurance policy is clearly a contract because the policyholder makes a promise to pay money to the insurance company, which in turn agrees to likewise pay the policyholder in certain contingencies or if certain contingencies arise. These promise to pay elements are essential for a contract, but they simply are not present with Social Security. First, Social Security payments are not premium payments, but are taxes instead. Secondly, there's no corresponding and enforceable promise to pay from the Social Security Administration to its beneficiaries. So as noted above, government contracts are very special and require an appropriation from Congress before money can be expended and a contract made. Regarding Social Security, the only beneficiaries who have any claim against the public treasury are those for whom Congress has already made an appropriation, which can last no longer than 1 year. The rest of the Social Security claimants in America have no enforceable claim on public funds, and all they possess is a political promise upon which Congress can renege at any moment. If Congress decided tomorrow to cut off all Social Security, nobody would have any claim for payment. Thus, Social Security has never been, nor is, and is not now, a contract. And you want to know something? Larry B. Craft is 100% correct. So why do I say Social Security is a contract? Well, let's flip over here and look at an unusual case in this chapter 13 here of tax and status. social security number. And back in about 1982 or 3, in a case called Bowen, Secretary of Health and Human Services versus public agencies opposed to social security entrapment. I think it was dated June 19th, 1986. It was argued April 28th, 1986. Bowen versus Secretary, or Bowen rather, Secretary of Health and Human Services et al. Versus public agencies opposed. Let me give you a little background here. Social Security Administration was established back in 1935. So there's no constitutional provisions for Congress to establish Social Security. But that doesn't make it unconstitutional. Congress can enact all kinds of legislation and get involved in all kinds of activities that don't have anything to do with the Constitution, but they're voluntary. For instance, you want to have a Social Security program, you go down and sign up for it. If you don't go down and sign up for it, you don't have to participate. You can't get any of the benefits. Well, now, most people want these benefits that come from Social Security. So when Congress established Social Security, they made a hell of a neat deal. You pay in a dollar and you get paid back 10 or 15. Nobody wants to pass up a Ponzi scheme like that. Today, though, when you pay in $5, if you're at the high-end bracket, you'll collect a dollar back. If you're in the middle-income bracket, you pay in $2.73 and you get back a dollar. If you're at the low-income, you pay in a dollar, you get 68 cents back. Now, that's the way it is today. But in the early days, you get paid back more than you want. So there aren't any cases that I know of in the literature where anybody ever challenged the compulsory nature of Social Security. Nobody went in and said, you can't make me join Social Security because I don't want to. And that's because nobody was ever forced to join Social Security. Two key cases came out in 1935, Stewart Machine versus Halvern, and another one, I forgot the name of it right off the top of my head. And all the Supreme Court said, in effect, was that, yeah, this tax is a tax on corporations, and corporations have to pay it. And they can deduct one half of it from their employees and pay it over to the government. This is a tax on the Commerce Clause. This is totally constitutional. But the workers didn't have to join. That was voluntary on their part. They didn't have to work for General Motors. They could have gone out and done something else. That's what they tell me when I go down and tell them that I have a right to travel in an automobile. And they say, no, you got to have a license to travel in an automobile. You can travel. You can walk. You can ride a horse. You can ride a bicycle, you know, but you can't drive a car without a license. Same thing here. You can make a living, you know, you can go out here and work and you can do all kinds of things, you just can't work for General Motors. So the Supreme Court comes in and says, okay, well, you can, Congress, you can make these laws over here, but you can't force these people to join. And nobody forced anybody to join. That's the trick. It's voluntary. And that's why I'm telling you, Social Security is contractual in nature. It's not the ordinary kind of contract. And I showed you in adhesion contracts that there's a number of different forms of contract. But a contract is an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration. Four elements to a contract. Five, if you consider the penal clause to the contract, which isn't necessary in order to establish a contract. And you'll see that the old covenant contract between the people and God didn't have a penal clause until Exodus chapter 33, I believe it was. Not until they broke the terms and conditions of the contract was the penal clause established in the old covenant. So it can be added later. In the case of driver's license, those penal clause statutes are established by the legislature. You know, if you're speeding, here's the fine schedule. If you're driving without a license, you know, here's the penalty. So there's a penal clause in addition to it. So that's the way that game comes down. Now, when Larry Beecraft says that, well, Social Security isn't a contract, well, he's right. It's not a contract in the ordinary sense of appropriations, but Social Security has money. Social Security has a program. Social Security has an appropriation. You go down and you sign up and you become a member. You get issued a number. You pay your money in, they pay you money out. They make you an offer, you accept the offer. It's not the kind of contract like we're dealing with here, building a courthouse, but it's still a contract. And as I said, the mere fact that it's voluntary shows that you went down and you accepted the offer. Social Security has a standing offer out there. You want to work for General Motors? Come on down, get a Social Security number. Go make your application at GM. And I declined the offer. So I can't work anywhere. Well, not normal commerce. Like, I can't work in commercial business. Somebody said to me, well, aren't you sorry that you don't have a Social Security number and that you can't work in commercial business? Not at all. I don't want to pay the tax. I don't want to pay in $5 and get a dollar back. No, I'm not sorry at all. So anyway, there's my answer to Larry's argument. Larry's not pulling your leg. He cited all the correct, and government would tell you Social Security is not a contract. Well, here again, I want to just ask you, Raymond, just you tell me, what do you think it is? It's black, it's white, it stinks real bad. It smells like a skunk. Now, you can call it a civet cat, you can call it a coon, you can call it a kitten, you can call it a lion, you can call it a tiger. You can call it a one-eyed, one-horned purple people eater if you want to. But you know, the bottom line is, if it's got an offer and it's got an acceptance and it's over time, it's got consideration. Sounds like a contract to me. And with the series that I just put on here for 2 days here concerning adhesion contracts, I went through a whole host and plethora of authorities that said, well, here's the way contracts work. There's more than one kind of contract. Building a courthouse is one form of contract. Social Security is another. Driver's license is a third. And while government will tell you plainly, and while the authorities and the dictionary says For legal purposes, a license is not a contract. I agree. It's not a contract in the normal sense. And when we talk about licenses, we'll get into the distinctions between a license contract and an adhesion contract. The driver's license is an adhesion contract, but it's a special hybrid form of it. All right, we're at the halfway point here. Let me give you a reminder. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the law school and the law, or please go to our website, georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it's open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact discs. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the law school direct, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. And a final reminder, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to the website, georgegordon.org, or call the law school direct, 417-273-4967. All right. So that takes care of Larry Beecraft. Now, I wanted to show you this Bowen versus agencies opposed to Social Security entrapment and show you what happened in that case. This is another case of a contract dealing with Social Security. So back in 35, Congress established the Social Security, and they brought in the industrial workers. Well, about 1950, they wanted to bring in the public employees. You know, the public employees of California, the guys that are out here fixing the bridges and potholes and the roads, public employees. So they came up with a 418G amendment. The conclusion that Congress reserved the authority to amend not only Section 418, but Section 4, but also 418, I believe it was 418G. Yeah, here it is, 418G. And they said, okay, look, you public employees in all the states, we need to move our Ponzi scheme up a notch. We got to have more people paying in. So if you don't like the program, give us notice, and you can opt out of it. Just give us 36 months notice, and you can opt out. So Governor Earl Warren, 1950. Earl Warren is the governor of California, and he signs the 418G agreement with the Social Security Administration, and the California public employees go into the Social Security program. All right, so they're in the program for 30 years, and first of all, I think it was Alaska, as I recall. Alaska, they decided they wanted to opt out with their 36 public employees, and so when Alaska opted out, it was no big deal. And then I think Nevada decided they wanted to opt out, and they had 41 employees, and so they decided that they'd opt out. Now, California's got about 3 million public employees, and they decided Social Security wasn't as good a program as they thought it was, and so they gave notice that they wanted to opt out, and Congress went into executive session, repealed 418G, and said, once in, always in. Well, the public employees of California said, wait a minute. Under the terms and conditions of the agreement, 1950, if we want to opt out of the program, all we have to do is give you 36 months notice and we can opt out. And for you to change the law is an ex post facto law. That's unconstitutional. They sued and they went to the Supreme Court of the United States. Now listen to what the Supreme Court of the United States had to say about the California public employees who wanted to opt out of Social Security, which under the terms of 418G was their right to do. So let me get my book over here. I'll read you some of the highlights. The Social Security Act of 1935, cited at 49 Statute 620, as amended 42 U.S.C. 301 et seq., established an insurance program for persons working in industry and commerce as a long-run safeguard against the occurrence of old age dependency. To ensure that this important program could evolve as economic and social conditions changed, Congress expressly reserved to itself the right to alter, amend, or repeal any provision of the Act, 42 U.S.C. Section 1304. So, no. Back in 1935, when Congress established the Social Security Act, they put a clause in the contract. And it says, if at any time we want to, Congress can alter, amend, or repeal any provision of the Act. Wrote it right in there. Just as big and bold as you can get. Then in 1950, they came to the California public employees. In fact, they came to the public employees of every state in the union and said, give us 36 months notice and you can opt out. Well, the states enter the system by executing an agreement, a 418 agreement, with the Secretary of Health and Human Services, the Secretary. And as of 1983, some 9.4 million out of approximately 13.2 million state and local employees participated in the Social Security system. And then finally over here on page 10, Congress anticipated that it would be necessary to respond to ever-changing conditions with flexibility and boldness, and therefore included in the Act a clause expressly reserving to it, the Congress, the right to alter, amend, or repeal any provision of the Act, cited at Section 1104, 49 Statute, 648, 42 U.S.C., Section 1304. That provision makes express what is implicit in the institutional needs of the program. And as the appealees must concede, the Act itself, including the original version of 418G, created no contractual rights. See Fleming versus Nestor. Now remember what Larry B. Kraft said about no contractual rights and Congress could just shut off Social Security payments in the morning? He's exactly right. Exactly right. Well, B. Kraft's contention is that it's not a contract because it doesn't meet the criteria of a certain type of contract, and he's right. It's not that type of contract. It's a special hybridized, unusual form of adhesion contract. And I didn't make it that way. I'm just reporting to you. That's the way it is. And when B. Kraft said, well, Congress doesn't have to pay you a dime. That's exactly correct. Says so right here in Bowen. Congress says, Congress can repeal Social Security in the morning. They don't have to give you any notice. They don't have to pay you a quarter. But that doesn't mean that you don't have a contract. That doesn't mean that you don't have an obligation or an agreement. You just try, stop paying your Social Security tax and see what happens. Now, under Social Security, it's called a tax. Under insurance, it's called a premium. What the hell difference does it make whether you call it a tax or a premium? You have to contribute money to the program. The Supreme Court called the Social Security program insurance. Well, I got news for you, boys and girls. Back in 1953, Senator Harlow Curtis, then a representative in the House of Representatives, held committee hearings and they brought in Arthur Altmaier. Arthur Altmaier. Now, Arthur Altmaier was a New Deal Democrat, came in from Minnesota back in 1933, and he's the architect of Social Security. He crafted it right out of the George Rapp Harmony Society. I did a series on Social Security. Just look it up on the archives. And Altmaier went around the country selling Social Security from 1933 to 1939. In Look Magazine, Life Magazine, CBS, he was quoted and cited for 11 years, from 1935 through 46, 11 years. And he called it insurance. He called it social insurance. Well, the Curtis Committee, it's the House Subcommittee on Appropriations, got down on the bottom line, and when Curtis wrote his report, he said, Congress has been deceived by believing that Social Security is insurance when in fact it is not. Because you see, insurance is a contract that has to be paid, and Social Security is not a contract and does not have to be paid. And that's what the House Committee on Appropriations said. Ah, but now hang on a second. Just because Congress has a provision in the contract that says we can repeal it anytime we want, let's take a look at a credit card. You know, we have a Seventh Amendment right, and under the Seventh Amendment, if you have a controversy, you can go into federal court and sue in all matters in excess of $20. You know that? Just take a look at Seventh Amendment, $20. You can go sue. Now, let's suppose that you have a complaint against GMAC or Ford Motor Credit, and you want to sue Ford Motor Company. You know what's going to happen to you? You go into federal court. You know, you bought this car in California. You moved to Florida. The car was built in Flint, Michigan or someplace, and you want to sue. This interstate commerce, no doubt about it. You can sue in federal court. You've got a complaint. Do you know what's going to happen to you? That federal judge is going to throw you out because Ford Motor is going to come in with a motion to dismiss. And you know why it's going to be granted? Because in the contract, in the agreement, you agreed to binding arbitration. And so all these big corporations are putting binding arbitration clauses in their contracts. Now, that doesn't mean it isn't a contract because you can't sue on it. All it means is that in the terms and conditions of the contract, there's a provision in there, and there's a provision in the Social Security contract. That's all that boils down to. Social Security is an adhesion contract. It's a contract because it has an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration. That's my contention. It's not an ordinary contract. It's not a meeting of the minds. It's not the kind of contract that you like to think that you've made with General Motors. And when, by the way, those contracts are adhesion contracts. They're just take it or leave it contracts. Just go in and buy a new Chevrolet automobile. Tell them, I don't like the terms and conditions of this pre-printed GMAC contract. Let's get a napkin out here and rework the terms and conditions here. See where that goes. just go ahead and test that. I mean, you can come over here to me and you and I can sit down, hammer out an agreement on buying an old milk cow. And we can have a meeting of the minds, and that's a contract. The Ten Commandments and the deal that God made with the people of Israel, it's called the Old Covenant, that's a contract. The Constitution of the United States is a contract. All laws are predicated upon contract. It's an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration. Just tuck that one away in your heart. And there's more than one kind of contract. There's a lot of them. A lot of different kinds of ways for you to get involved in agreements. And this is why the First Commandment comes along and says, you shall have no other gods before me. And God told you, said, don't make any covenants or agreements with these foreign and alien gods, sovereigns, lawmakers. Now, I got a couple of letters in here that kind of lend themselves to this discussion. So let me read this letter here. Let's see if I can cover all three, and I'll show you what happens here. First one, hello, George. I recently listened to your 4-program series on antique firearms. I was wondering one thing. If all guns prior to 1899 are not regulated in commerce, but in order to use these guns for self-defense, a person needs to buy ammunition that is regulated in commerce, then wouldn't that put any individual in violation of the law if they're one of the 9 types of people that are prohibited from using guns in commerce? Sincerely, Paul. Well, machine guns are not regulated if you make it yourself in your own machine shop, remember? And you can load your own ammunition with black powder, or there was another provision, remember, if you've got one of these odd caliber guns, some of these weird calibers, go back and listen to those 4 programs again, and I think it's probably in the third or fourth program, in which I covered that in the article, that they don't regulate, though, say, a 36 caliber, 45 caliber, 44 caliber, those are common, but there was a 43 caliber in there that's not regulated. And black powder isn't regulated, and ammunition that you make at home isn't regulated, and ammunition that's made in your state that doesn't enter interstate commerce isn't regulated, and why don't you pay for it with gold coin? That's another thought. Now again, notice that this guy and all of us, you know, I'm a citizen of the United States, and you're a citizen of the United States, and we come under the laws of the United States, and these are called the general laws of the United States, and so it's against the law for me to have a machine gun. It's against the law for me to have an Uzi, fully automatic machine gun, because it comes under Hale versus Henkel. Corporations are regulated and controlled. When I buy one of those, it's in commerce. They regulate commerce, and so they regulate fully automatic machine guns. You have to have a permit. You got to pay the $225 tax. But I can make my own Borden machine gun in my own shop, and I have a constitutional right under the Second Amendment to do that. So regulation comes under the Commerce Clause. Now, how do we get regulated? If we have constitutional rights under Hale versus Henkel, we join corporate capacity. That's that adhesion contract. You go in here and you buy a Smith & Wesson. Well, Smith & Wesson is a corporation regulated under Hale versus Henkel. That's principle, that doctrine of law. You go in and use Federal Reserve notes, join commerce, and you too can be regulated under the same statutes that regulate Smith & Wesson. So tuck that one away in your heart. A lady by the name of Lynn writes me, and she says, I got a question. After listening to the series on Freemasons and the Antichrist, you have continued to allude to the founding of this country not being what we were taught in school. You hint that it was somewhat of an experiment of the Illuminati. If I'm perceiving this correctly, could you do a program on this subject? I think there's more to learn and understand coming from this perspective. Well, I've done a series of programs, Lynn, on Masonry and the Illuminati. If you'll just look up Masons on the archives, there's a bunch of programs there. And I just did a series on the common law. Let's see if I can get this one in quickly here. I have not missed. This comes from a guy named, what's this guy's name? George. Sincerely yours, George. He says, I haven't missed one of your shows for about 2 years. And I live in Humboldt County, California. The past year, I resided in my van. I'm 57 years old. Currently, I reside in Arcata, California. I've been vaguely aware that it is quite probably illegal to live in my van, but up until now, the police have completely ignored me. Okay, hang on a second. Why would it be illegal for this guy to live in his van? Well, it's because the van belongs to the state of California and it's regulated and controlled under the California vehicle statutes. You know, if you're going to live in my house, like, you're not going to have the same kind of freedoms that you would have if you were living in your own house. All right, so George, you're living in the state's van. He says, now with summer coming on and the downturn of the economy, the police have started a crackdown. I went to the city hall and requested the relevant ordinance, and I was referred to section 10004, overnight use prohibited. Section 10004, overnight use prohibited, amended by ordinance number 1205. There is to be no camping on public grounds nor overnight use of public grounds or public buildings unless specifically authorized by the city manager or her or his designee. Camping is defined as temporarily living or occupying an area in the outdoors. And I also have a copy of the amended version 1205, but it's not online, and I have to scan it in. It doesn't seem to say or change much relevant to my issue. It is my understanding that this ordinance is used to enforce a no sleeping in vehicle policy, but from what I can tell, this ordinance only applies to public grounds and public buildings. So I'm asking your opinion as to the legality of this application of this ordinance, and more importantly, what I should do and say if I'm cited. And if the issues are complex, perhaps you could devote a program on this, as it's pure discrimination on the individuals that are unable to purchase property. Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do here, George. I'm going to take the next program in this series here that we're dealing with here with contracts. And I'll tell you about Pat Conley, who built a house with no building permit, because he too was a poor person. Poor. It's not a crime to be poor. In fact, the Supreme Court of the United States struck down vagrancy back in 1964 as being a discriminatory policy against the poor. So vagrancy is unconstitutional. Now here's a real special aspect of vagrancy. There are about 275,000 convictions nationwide on vagrancy every year. Did you know that? on a statute that's been struck down as unconstitutional. How does that work? Well, it works by contract. It works by agreement. You see, the policeman comes up and says, I'm going to charge you with vagrancy because you don't have any money. You're under arrest, and he throws you in jail. Then they bring you up in front of the judge, and the judge says, how do you want to plead to this charge of vagrancy? And you say, well, I want to plead guilty to this charge of vagrancy. And the judge says, okay, your guilty plea is accepted, and we're going to sentence you to time served because you don't have any money, no point in giving you a fine, and so on. And so you've been in jail for a week or 3 days or whatever, and they give you credit for time served, and you walk out the door. The court just made a sale. You know, they said, would you like to plead guilty to this charge? And you said, yeah, I'd like to buy a guilty plea today, and I'd like to pay 3 days of my life. And you see, when they fill up a bed in the jail, it's like Holiday Inn filling up a room. They have a vacancy factor that they have to consider. It's called the law enforcement growth industry. And they got a jail there, and they got jailers, and they have to justify those beds that they have in there. So you'll find out over the weekend, like Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, they fill up all the beds in the jail. And then on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, they empty the beds. And then on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, they fill them all up again. It's like Holiday Inn and Ramada and Best Western motels. See how that works? Now, to solve your problem over here, if you want to sleep in your van, all you have to do is move out of the city, go out into the county. You can park your van in truck stops. They'll welcome you in a truck stop. They don't care. So if you go to the truck stops, or if you'll go out into the county and just go off on a county road and pull off anywhere you want, just like a person's driving down the highway, go to a public rest area on the interstate. Just pull in there, and they don't care if you sleep in your car. All those truckers are sleeping, you know, in those rest areas. And when they pull off on the side of the road, that's what the trucker is doing in there. He's sleeping in his truck. And you won't have any problem. But you don't have any right to sleep in a city park or in a public location. Especially if the powers that be say, well, thou shalt not park here. Thou shalt not. This is called a regulation. So we're going to regulate the use of your automobile. And so you can't sleep in your automobile here on the public streets. So you have to move to a place where it's not regulated. That's all. That's a simple enough story. But I'll tell you about Pat Connolly tomorrow night. I'm about out of time, so I'm going to have to wrap it up right here. Remember, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that's open to individuals by prearrangement. Remember, The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call The Law School direct, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. There's the signal. Since time's up, I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.